You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila. Delicious and smooth tequila, made in harmony with the earth. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Greetings from Cheeselandia, where cheese lovers, cheese makers, cheese nibblers, and cheese curious are all welcome. Find the really good stuff, meet the makers, and connect with fellow travelers on the cheese way of life. Visit wisconsincheese.com to learn more and sign up.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. It's June 14th, 2022. It's Flag Day, and what's more American than hard cider, right? I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host here on Beer Sessions Radio. And yes, we'll be talking about hard cider. So let's go around the room and introduce our esteemed guests. Each one of these gentlemen are well-known in the world of hard cider, and each have totally different approaches to everything. And I'm really honored that they were able to join in. And it seems like this month we're dedicating to hard cider. So let's go around the room. So I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host. Jim?
I'm James Aspel, and I'm an importer of Spanish cider.
All right. Peter?
I'm Peter Mitchell. The American Peter Mitchell, not the Brit, who's much better cider maker than I. I own Headwater Cider up here in Holly, Mass.
In Massachusetts. And Ron?
I'm the owner and cider maker at Spoke and Spy Cider in Middletown, Connecticut, and I'm the current president of the Cider Institute of North America.
All right. So we all share a few things in common. One of them is that last year we were all at Cider Feast New England, north of Boston, which is coming up next week, and it was great getting everyone together. Ron, you were a big part of the introductions and bringing so many of the cider folk into that event. How are you doing? How's everything going? And let's check in with you.
Up here, everything's going really well. Our cidery, we're still making tons of cider. I've actually closed our tasting room to focus on wholesale, getting kegs to accounts. And we're trying to move down the road and open up a bigger, better cidery. And hopefully that happens sometime soon.
That's great. And you're in Middletown, Connecticut, right?
Yep, right in the middle.
That's great. And then Peter, I met you last year also at Cider Feast, and you came out east. I was up north of Boston. Tell me a little bit about your operations at Headwater and what you're working on right now.
Well, I just got off the tractor with enough time to hop in the shower today. We got 2,000 trees on 20 acres. Our motto is grow what you press what you grow. We make pretty much exclusively dry ciders. We do them in 5-gallon kegs because I don't want to lift a bigger keg. And we do them in 750s and some 12-ounce bottles as well. And what else can I say? Oh, James Aswell, you should be happy with this. I just scored 150 new trees. Wow. And they include Sangre de Toro and Coloradana. So
cool.
Those will be fun. Those are some good Spanish cider apples.
Awesome. That's great to hear. And I'll say why when I come on.
And now you're on, Jim.
Oh, okay.
Tell us a little about you. I met you. I know you lived in Rhode Island and you were an architect, but
I know your brother.
My brother, Chris Carboni.
Yeah, I do, man. I do. He's a local celebrity there in Rhode Island. Yeah. So, so I've been importing for 10 years. Can talk to that, but also after 4 years in the Pacific Northwest, sort of driving sales, my wife and I moved back to Western Mass, also the Connecticut River Valley, and we're starting an orchard. Now, our recent planting is 40 trees, not, what'd you say, Peter, 2,000?
This is 2 grand.
Yeah. And so we're planting seedling rootstock for standard sized trees, which we're going to keep small by pruning, but they're going to be relatively big, and they're going to be slow. And our goal is really to have, and why I'm so glad to hear Peter's got some Spanish, our goal is to have a kind of demonstration Spanish orchard, both size, tree type and spacing, so that people who can't go over to Spain, which y'all should anyway, can sort of get a sense of what a Spanish orchard is. And of course, when we graft, we're going to graft all Spanish varietals. So it's great to hear Peter's out there ahead of me and, you know, find out what works before I jump in.
Yeah.
Well, if I can grow them, we'll see that. That's always the trick. Yeah. It's like, yeah, you have the nice variety, but can you produce it?
Is it going to work in this area? Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. So, guys, Peter, I don't know if all of our listeners probably don't know who Peter Mitchell is. And, you know, I'd say many of our listeners are probably craft beverage enthusiasts who would like to learn more. And I think what I'm most interested in is just the differences between the three of you before we talk about similarities. So, like, how would each of you describe what good cider is, but in the context of what you're growing or making or selling? I want to start with Ron, because Ron, you're quite a legend. You're involved with the Cider Institute of North America and many things before you were even making cider.
The ciders I like, I really like dry still ciders with a lot of complexity. But as a cider maker, I know that consumers love sweeter, fruitier. So, I mean, I make a lot of that, but I drink a lot of, dry, some sparkling.
And then are there any countries that inspire you? I mean, honestly, like, we're going into Cider Feast and there's a lot of people that like cider. Some people drink cider because it's gluten-free option. I think in most places I go when I'm outside of some of the cities, the most people haven't really been exposed to that many different styles of cider.
Yeah, most people think cider is just sweet and very like candy. But I really like Spain, Asturias. A lot of what Jim brings in is fantastic, some of the best ciders I've ever had. So I always try to get people to experiment with, experience the Spanish side.
Yeah, Ron actually brings in some bulk, when I bring in a container, sometimes he has as many as 2,000 liter totes in it for himself and his own use in the cidery. He puts some on tap. And Ron, you correct me, but I think you probably do some blends with some of your own ferments. Is that right?
Yep, it's all blends. And it's kind of like what we did with the Chai and Dry. We did a collaboration can.
I love that
Spanish
stuff.
Cedro.
I love that.
Glad to hear. It was a home it was a home run at Portland Cider Summit the other day. Just absolutely a home run.
And we're trying to work on some more in the line. So that'll be exciting.
Yeah. Just to speak to that, I really enjoy working with Ron. I've known him, originally know Ron from doing Franklin County Cider Days, and he was volunteer enthusiastically doing long pours for people to taste my cider. So we've had a conversation for quite some time. And when I decided to start doing some blending myself in Massachusetts at my locale, and I knew that he had experience blending my cider, so I invited him to work with me on this collaboration. And it's worked out really well.
Jim, what was it about Spain that captivated you? You know, you were an architect, and then next thing you know, you're importing cider.
Yeah. Well, you don't really want to know the whole story because it would take too long. But the short of it is, I fell in love with Spain in 1974 on study abroad when I was a college student, so much so that I've gone back many times in many different roles, working, teaching, and my most continuous gig there, a summer program for architecture students, that I ran it in the north in the cider region. So I have, you know, going back to 1982, that's my cider. And being an American, I never had any cider, hard cider before then, because there wasn't any around except the stupid shit we did in our dormitories under the bed, you know, and didn't work out very well. So when I saw cider coming on the scene in the U.S., you know, 10, 11 years ago, I was very disappointed that there was nothing very dry and there was nothing malolactic and et cetera. And in looking around for sources in the country, I ended up becoming the importer.
That's a great origin story. And Ron, why don't you tell us more about Jim and Ciders of Spain? Because you did bring that Chai and Dry last year to Cider Feast.
Yeah, it was a blend that we did. We actually found this fantastic tea company in Massachusetts, the Tea Guys. And he made like a proprietary blend of chai. And we worked with some local apple juice and the cedra. And we put it all together in a can. And I think it came out like magic. And I think, you know, the future ones we're very excited for.
Yeah, a little bit more backstory on that particular tea, because we're going to do more tea blends, right, Ron?
Yep.
And that is, we started with that one because it wasn't just like me looking for what like more I could do to fuck up Spanish cider to make Americans like it. So, pardon me. I don't know what your language standards are here. Apologize. But you know, for 10 years, I've been going and doing sales calls, and much of that time before I started canning, going around with bottles. So I'd come home at the end of the day with, you know, partial bottles of cidre natural and going into the kitchen to cook. And there was always like a half full pot of tea that had been sitting there for the day because my wife was at home. And I would just make this refreshing blend on ice of black tea and cider. And it needed a little something else. It needed a little sweetener and it needed something else. So I was using Angostura bitters, and that became like, that's a thing for me. And so what we're doing with the chai and dry is kind of like trying to get back to that, which I think Ron tried it out. I gave him the recipe. He tried it out before we had the tea guys on board. And then when the tea guys came on board, you know, it's like, what do we do for the Angostura bitters? Do we go buy a bunch? And our brilliant partner, Mr. Rich said, no, let's try this chai, and it worked.
Oh, that's a great little story. And Peter, so tell me more about your week. I saw that last month you got in 2,000 pounds of glass.
I did, and it's still sitting there. We've got to start bottling like soon. It's like a lot of things are just getting crazy. Like today we're expecting finally brand new $7,000 mower is coming as soon as we're done here. Hopefully the truck will arrive. I also started making ice cider again this past winter, and I had a lot of leftover cryo concentrated juice that wasn't high enough bricks for ice cider, but much higher than you would get out of a fresh pressing. So I added that back to the tanks of already fermenting cider, and it's like, oh, well, we just reset the clock to zero again because we know we got to ferment this. We're about ready to go with that. I was hoping to start this coming weekend, but the 150 trees are coming in this weekend, so I got to dig 150 holes. So yeah, things are a little busy right now.
What's the biggest thing you worry about, Peter, when you're planting and growing? Since we're talking about growing.
Believe it or not all apples grow the same. You can't treat them all the same. Besides the fact that some bloom later than others, or some get harvested earlier than others, which is always a bit of a hassle about, you know, when you pick them, because we have no cold storage. You have to wait to exact ripeness, basically when they just start to fall. Some are more disease susceptible than others. There's a disease called fire blight, which is really nasty. I used to have 100 Medal d'Or, which is a little French cider apple, which is just loaded with tannins. But they're so susceptible, I finally had to pull them out. What I'm trying to do is just use the apples I grow myself, try to get, you know, in touch with this region, with this terroir. Ron can answer this better. The British Peter Mitchell is going to be coming to Cornell in Geneva, New York, to teach a course coming up this summer, isn't he? Like in July, and I think there's still room there, isn't it?
I think there is definitely some spaces in the classes. He teaches on both coasts, so it's not just Cornell.
I would say that most of the granddaddies around here, like, you know, West County, Farnhamville, have all gone through Peter Mitchell's course out there, and it's well worth it.
I want to comment on that. I really do. And I don't want to be a pill, but these things need to be out there. So I took Peter Mitchell's course, too, after I started Ciders of Spain. And I, at that particular point, I wasn't planning on making cider, but I wanted to see what the new cider makers were learning how to do. And Peter Mitchell, of course, the other Peter Mitchell, not knowing anything about me, basically said that Spanish cider isn't any good. And yeah, and I'm sitting there, I called him on it, and he said, well, at any rate, you can only drink it over there, so don't try to make it over here. And, you know, that's my business. I bring it in. And he's dissing my business, you know, just offhand, quite frankly, without any basis for talking. So he teaches people how to never make anything like Spanish cider. Just keep that in mind.
And very true.
And I know a lot of the people because I went to a class really early on. I know a lot of the people who are now running cideries and stuff like that. And congratulations to them for getting started, having this kind of training wheel lesson on how to make a limited cider with no risk whatsoever, because the goal is all, you know, maximum commercial production. That's quite frankly what that's about, and probably very realistic. But my congratulations to the many who are now trying wild yeast ferments. Some are actively trying to make Spanish style ciders, which I totally endorsed. I think that's great. And it was part of our goal to introduce Spanish cider was not just to be the only one selling Spanish cider, but to introduce the style. So so go into that course with an open mind.
You are correct, James, that, you know, he is a Brit and he's going to teach you British cider making techniques. And he's going to want to say, OK, it's got to be dry and loaded with a lot of tannins. And yes, we want a depth to it, but it's going to fit within that definition of his cider.
But he doesn't say it that way. He says it's cider generic and that anything else isn't. And he also, by the way, when he's dealing with organoleptic analysis, says that cider can't possibly have umami. Well, of course, if you freeze out the malolactic in your process, you're not going to have umami. And my view at the time and continues to be, like, who said cider shouldn't remind you of sausage?
Will you? All right. Now back to Ron. I'm going to talk about what you guys are doing today because I like to hear about the work that's involved. So, Ron, you said you were busy bottling.
Yeah, we bottled 1,000 liters over the last couple of days. We did these nice 500 milliliter cork and cage bottles. It's like a dry, sparkling cider.
Yeah, why did you decide on that? You have a unique little packaging. Why did you decide on that at Spoke and Spy?
Oh, this is a project for someone. It's not directly a Spoke and Spy cider. So.
Yeah. But
so it's under the direction of the organic grower.
But still, with the differences, you know, we talk so much in beer about cans, and people don't really talk about bottles too much anymore. Let's talk about bottles and cider, because – you know, obviously there's different sizes and.
Yeah, I think, you know, most of the great ciders are in bottles, but I think most of the ciders in America are in cans. So.
Ditto.
I have nothing against cans. I can a little. I bottle a little, but mostly I keg.
Kegs are wonderful. If you can get a restaurant to give you a tap. Because that first pour is going to be exactly like the last pour. I like to put the cider in a 750 because my price point is usually less than most of the wines on the wine list at a restaurant. And hey, you could put this bottle on the table just as well.
Yeah, so I'll speak for cans. And that's ironic because, you know, this whole thing is evolving. When I started out, you know, and it's, of course, it's really important with a traditional cider to have the experience of the long pour from the traditional 700 milliliter green bottle. And I still offer all my bottles, but like 80% of my sales right now are cans. And if I weren't in cans, there'd be no more Spanish cider from Ciders of Spain in America because I wouldn't be able to survive. That's dictated by the buyer and the stores. And when you go into the stores these days, if you're me looking to make a sale, you will observe that the shelf spacing from shelf to shelf vertically is can height. And the only space, except with some exceptions, because they don't put ciders in the wine section, is the very top row, which is, of course, above eye level. So I said I would never do it. I'm doing it now. There's other things I said I would never do that experience is teaching me to be more flexible. And also, you know, modest success over time, like having demonstrated that I am serious about traditional Spanish cider, and that's what I represent, has given me the credibility to try new things, not just in terms of packaging, but in terms of styles and blending. So I think it's all, you know, the canning thing, there's no reason for it to be seen as a lesser form. And there is some issue with the life of the cider in a can because of deterioration of the liner. We just have to be careful about that. And I won't go into it, but I have my ways of making sure that what I put out there is really fresh.
Jim, tell us about when you went out to Portland, Oregon, and conquering the Pacific Northwest market.
I wish I could say conquering. You know, I'm back here now after COVID because I'm trying to retake a little ground. But yeah, so I had a very great director of sales who was taking care of the East Coast, and he was doing so well in Massachusetts, New York, Rhode Island, Connecticut. He was doing so well that I was like superfluous, and it was kind of embarrassing to even be going out and doing sales. So I left partly because we'd been for a couple, 3 years already on the West Coast, and I'd never been advocating for it out here. I'm out here now, so out here. And so we moved out for 4 years to kind of live and be part of the community. And so we've established, you know, some good, solid, consistent customers out here, including a really large chain, which I'm working on kind of revisiting and re-energizing out here in California called Beverages and More, which has like 140 stores in California. On the other hand, doing a tasting event at Crooked City Cider, which is a small, you know, owner-run cider house in Oakland. But yeah, it's really great out here. It's a great cider community in terms of making in the Pacific Northwest. A fair amount of making, but not as intense, not as many people in California, but good makers in California. And so I really enjoy the opportunity. But I'm back in the Northeast now because I really love my New England cider and New England cider makers. And that's where I want to be when I start making some demonstration batches of cider, which is really, you know, the time that we have left and the rate of development of the orchard, you know, it's going to be a very modest operation.
That's great. Hey, Peter, I know in beer, there's a lot of collaborations, you know, between brewers and, you know, they're standing around and most of it's done in advance. They work on the recipe and order the malts and everything. And then they have great photo ops, not knocking collabs because they're awesome. But I noticed over the winter, you were up at our friends at Farnham Hill and you guys were mucking around in the orchards. Is that a collaboration or, you know, tell me about.
What the heck was I doing up there?
Yeah.
besides taking pictures of owls in the snow, yes. No, he's got some great varieties up there. He's got Ashton Bitter and Ellis Bitter up there. I have tried them. We got about 100 sticks total, and we grafted them onto some Macintosh and Cortland trees here. Most of them have taken, so that's going to yield fruit in about 3 years. So we're actually switching over trees from Macintosh and Cortland to Ellis Bitter and Ashton Bitter. Got some good tannins in those and higher bricks, higher sugar content than you would normally get out of a Cortland and Empire. Plus, UNH, University of New Hampshire, was running a grafting course for the purposes of developing trap trees. Okay, that's kind of geeky grower talk. You make sort of sacrificial lambs out of a few of your trees on the edge of your orchard with varieties that you know the bugs really like. And you say, okay, all bugs over here. And then all you have to do is spray those few trees instead of your whole orchard. Saves a lot of money and time.
Yeah, my Spanish growers who produce the fruit for my cider makers were telling me about that as well. So, yeah, glad to hear you reiterate it.
It works well. Farm has been doing that for like 10, 12 years now, and I've just started it. Of course, it's freshly grafted, so it's going to take 3 years to get them to really start flowering. But yeah, those will be the goat trees.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I don't think I realize just how risky what you're doing is.
Growing anything is Las Vegas in the dirt. You know, sometimes you have a really great crop, sometimes you don't.
Oh yeah, and then Jim, you don't have anything negative to say about the grafting course, then?
Oh, I haven't taken it, but I'm going to learn grafting locally. We've got some great. Besides Peter Mitchell, who's a friend who's always available to help me out and advise me, and I draw on him, we have Matt Kaminsky, who is kind of, I think, the man. So
he's a grafting maniac. He sure is.
Yeah, and he teaches a grafting course and many other tree care courses. So once I'm settled, we've only been there a year, and we've been like kind of scrambling, finding properties and working them and stuff. But once I get settled, I'll take all of Matt's courses for sure.
So you should check out Matt online. It's Gnarly Pippins. Yeah.
And all three of you, when you mentioned Franklin County and Franklin County Cider Days and that area, what about it? Why is that the center of so much a Northeast cider? American cider. I know it inspired Tom Oliver to create a Bristol Cider Summit in England.
Well, this has been Franklin County has been the epicenter of apple growing in Massachusetts. I mean, yeah, we can also go all the way back that Johnny Appleseed was born in Leominster, Mass. But even in Sarah down at the mobile station. Her family's been here forever.
And I love that.
Gave me a copy of a newspaper clipping, and I think it was in 1902 or something. Some insane amount of cider came out of these hills, like over a million gallons. And you got to remember, these are steep hills, and they're hauling this stuff up and down the slopes with oxen and horses. And so there was a whole bunch of cider. There's lovely abandoned orchards deep in the woods here. And it's just a beautiful heritage for apples.
I went foraging with Peter last year, and
that's right. Gordon.
It was amazing, and we were identifying, by taste, identifying these random varieties, that the ones that we liked, and tagging the trees, and Peter was GPS locating them with intentions we didn't fulfill last year, but maybe this year, Peter, huh? We'll go pick some of those, and maybe I'll take some cuttings now that I have some rootstock in the ground.
Oh, yeah, I think it's time we should head on out there with Gordon, and but we'll bring some backpacks and stock up on some apples.
Yeah, because I gotta make some cider this year. I got a lot to learn and little time left. I sometimes, go, what the hell am I doing planting an orchard of trees that are going to take 7 to 10 years to mature in my life, at my age? And I realize, oh, no, those trees are going to keep me alive.
You're right, Jim.
Hey, we should probably give a shout-out to some other locals out here, like Bear Swamp, Cidery, and West County. And the new kids, Berkshire Cider Project, they're all doing wonderful things out there.
I heard, talking about Pacific Northwest, I heard from a farmer I bought lamb from a few months ago that somebody came into her shop who just bought 90 acres up in Leiden, that had just was moving from the Pacific Northwest to start a big orchard up here in Franklin County.
Really? Wow.
I have not been able, and I heard about them again, so I think it's true, but I haven't been able to locate that. I'm sure curious why, if it's true, somebody is moving from the Pacific Northwest, which we know is great apple growing country, why they want to move to New England. I have my theories, but they're, you know, idle theories based on no confirmation this is actually happening.
Yeah. Well, if it were, would it be climate change? Is it the price of land?
It's not the price of land. It's sure ain't the price of land.
I'm going to guess that, as you said, since growing an orchard is a long-term investment, that it's likely to be a climate change consideration. If you're going to start now with the droughts that they've been having here and the smoke. And I, you know, one of the things and I'm not trying to diss the Pacific Northwest, believe me, I'm here now more or less than I was there, and I'm going back in September. And there's some great cider makers that have mentored me in terms of, I haven't been making yet, but in terms of flavor profiles that work here, in terms of working with my producers to get them. You know, we lived through a really bad smoke season where, you know, whatever the index scale was at 650, you know, something parts per million, whereas 450 is the limit of human safety. And so they do talk about smoke taint in the wine industry in Northern California and the Pacific Northwest. And a little murmuring about it with regard to apples. I think you hear less about it with apples when you're here because there's so much less, you know, there's so much more wine being produced than cider that it's a more, people are more aware of it. But I hope that's not, I mean, I hope we work through this. I hate to think that, you know, I hate to think that we're going to lose an important cider making region.
Yeah.
Well, you find out who that is, James, and you tell him to plant some Spanish cider fruit.
Yeah, I'm gonna get on it. You know, I've been tied up with the new property, but I'm gonna go around and just start like driving around Leiden and see what's going on.
Oh yeah. Hey, listen, this has been a great start and intro to our show. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
I'm Chava Perivan, co-host of Agave Road Trip on HRN, here to talk about 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods at a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. From the blue agave they grow to their recycled glass bottle, 818 emphasizes the earth's importance in all they do. Their distillery runs on biomass and solar power, which means they don't rely as much on fossil fuels and are able to reduce their carbon footprint. Their labels, corks, and boxes are all certified by the Forest Stewardship Council as coming from sustainably managed forests. 818 is a proud member of 1% for the Planet, through which they support HRN as well as Sacred, my organization in Jalisco, where together we transform agave byproducts and water waste into adobe bricks that are donated to local infrastructure projects, like a local library in Zapotitlán de Vadillo. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their sustainability efforts and find 818 near you. 818 has been part of so many magical nights for me, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Greetings from Cheeselandia, the ultimate community of cheese lovers. Cheeselandia is your golden pathway to the world of Wisconsin artisanal cheese, where you can immerse yourself in a vibrant society of cheese, in real life and online. Join this community of fellow travelers from all 50 states on the cheeseway of life and enjoy member-only events. Attend the School of Cheese, pursue cheese quests, and apply to host your own Cheeselandia house party. Visit wisconsincheese.com/cheeselandia to join.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Become a member and join us at heritageradionetwork.org. So we're talking about cider. It's the summer of cider. It's June. And this is the time to talk about cider. So we got James Aspel from Ciders of Spain, Peter Mitchell from Headwater Cider, and Ron Sansone from Spoken Spy Cider Works. So Ron, let's get back to you, because you are the most interesting guy in the room, but sometimes you're the quietest guy on the radio.
Yep.
Yep.
So what do you want to know?
Well, like more like let's talk about one. Weren't you making the pineapple cider?
Oh, yeah, I do tons of that. It's called Tapash Mode. It's a wild fermented pineapple with some spices like cinnamon and allspice and green cardamom and black pepper. It's pretty interesting and it's pretty popular. So that was one of the first ciders we made, and it's still one of our most popular.
And then where do you get your recipes?
I just make them up.
Do you?
I mean, everything's been done before, so I mean, you know, you search, you find things you like and pick a direction and, you know, use what you've learned in school to make your version of whatever you can.
Yeah.
It's true, man, that in this, you know, quickly evolving community and category, you think of something, you think, I thought of this, and you did. And then before you even release yours, somebody else has released something very similar to that, you know? So like with the Try and Dry that Ron and I did together, there's, I think, at least a couple of others out there. One of them that I know concretely is called Cider, that's made by Schilling Cider Company, Cider Company in Seattle, you know? So, you know, it's actually, there's so many of us out there, it's hard to actually be the first at anything because you're never alone.
Exactly. We're all working on it together.
Yes, it is. Just like cathedrals, I say. You know, you go around, you look at the consistency of cathedrals through any era, and it's because it was a community project, you know? I mean, nobody was telling anybody else what to do with their cathedral, but they had similar goals, similar spiritual goals. They were speaking in the language of the time and so forth and so on. And I'll tell you something that I while I admire all periods of architecture, sometimes I'm kind of impatient with contemporary architecture where the goal seems to be do something as unrecognizable to anything else. You know, it's just like, look at me, architecture. And, you know, architecture really wants to be live in me, worship in me, and cider wants to be drink me. You know, it doesn't want to be, you know, be weirded out by me. So,
if you have enough believers, you can build anything.
Yeah.
And maybe if there are enough people that work with wood and perhaps had built ships, would that have influenced the cathedrals?
Well, they're stone, you know. So, you know, the cathedrals are all stone. Actually, during the time of the cathedrals, the masonry trade was so absorbed, used up, sucked into making cathedrals that most of the other products, that's why there's so much, that then the parish churches are all brick, you know, because there were, you know, no masons left, no stonemasons left.
You raise a good point, James. You know, as you say, with the cathedrals, they took, you know, centuries to build. So obviously the original planners and builders were long dead before it was finished. And yet you also say, you know, you note the novelty of modern or contemporary architecture. And I think you can see both of those reflected in cider today. You know, there are some groups which are carrying on various traditions, world traditions.
Absolutely. Yeah,
and then some are trying stuff new.
Yep, absolutely. I think, you know, the correspondence between all aspects of culture, you know, music, art, culinary, beverage, architecture, you know, they have similar structures, underlying cultural structures that you can see strong parallels in. And sometimes it's actually very helpful to use one as a metaphor for the other, you know?
Well, cool. I always wanted to be an artist.
Well, since you're talking about cultural, all right, listen, cultural backgrounds, let's pin down two regions. First, let's talk about New England. And Peter, Ron, and James, New England and cider, why? And what was that culture about? Give me the 101.
Well, do you want to go with the impotability of okay, so it's 1740 and you're sitting in Boston or one of the other farm towns, and your 20-foot hand dug well is 10 feet away from your 10-foot hand dug privy, and it gets to be June and you're going like, yeah, I ain't drinking that water. fermentation kills bacteria. And if you're doing a wild ferment, you're probably going to have a very low alcohol product. So if you could do all this cider, you know, like barrels and barrels of it, it was something safe to drink during those low flow summer months when you didn't want it, when water was just awful.
And so they drank it in the morning because they needed water, and they drank it all day long, and kids drank it.
Hundreds of gallons.
But that's the whole culture for New England. Why did New England become, was it because of the era it was settled?
Yeah.
Why is New England this hotbed of American cider?
The earliest. We've just had more time, like a lot more time. When you look at how long there was settlement in New England before you started to have, you know, European settlement, of course, I mean, before you started to have, and let's just be frank, conquest moving westward. And related to that, which is very important to Ron and me and somewhat to Peter, is the Connecticut River Valley, which is where we're both situated. You know, that was the first fertile valley exploited in North America by European settlers before the Hudson Valley. And I'll just compare it with my time out here. I mean, in Oregon, the Willamette Valley, which flows, you know, from south in the mountains up through Portland and empties into the Columbia, is a huge fruit basket. But the Connecticut River is the earliest one and continues. So it has this, not just apples, but the Connecticut River has that, and I'm finding, and we're in the valley, has this tremendous culture of small farms and farming families that have been there for generations. And, you know, so it's the whole agricultural culture. And, is so much older,
and you know, there's the Connecticut River Valley down near where James is, and moving all the way down through to where Ron is. That's also Connecticut River is beautiful farmland, some of the best in the country. If you move up closer to the hills, you start getting into rocks, and so you can't really plow it, but you could dig an occasional hole and plant a tree.
Yeah,
that's really helpful.
Yeah, I just got through digging my, even though I'm like right on the edge of the Connecticut River Valley. And I mean, I can literally see the transition from the west side of my site to the east toward the valley, like literally in terms of the amount of rocks. And while I'm digging, I'm humming roots rock reggae to myself because that's what's in my holes, man. It's hard work.
Wow. Hey, Ron, what about in Connecticut? I know... you know, you're involved with more than just your own cidery in Connecticut. What about the history of cider there?
There are a few cideries that are doing pretty well now. I think cider is getting more popular in Connecticut. I'm starting to help. I started the Connecticut Cider Association 5 years ago.
Nice.
We're just trying to support all the cideries in Connecticut. And I'm working with probably like 4 or 5 Connecticut startups that are trying to launch in the next year or so. And some of these are like those classic, you know, families like they were talking about there, going back, you know, 5-10 generations who are just now getting into the hard cider side of the business. So,
hey, what about Clyde's? What can you tell us about Clyde's?
Oh, Clyde's is fantastic. It's a very interesting steam powered. It's like a engineering site. It's like a historic engineering location, steam-powered cider. I think they bring in the apples. I don't think they grow apples at all. I'm not even sure if they use Connecticut apples. But they do very interesting ciders that they sell in, like, gallon milk jugs.
So it's a steam-powered cidery in Connecticut.
And it has a claim to fame that it was one of the only cideries in America that managed to continue to operate through Prohibition, because the matriarch of the operation at that time had some influence with state politicians and managed to get their cider recognized as patent medicine. So they were making cider, hard cider, as patent medicine throughout the throughout Prohibition.
Since 1881.
And that's a good point you bring up, James, that we really should recognize that cider was pretty much the bad boy at Prohibition. I mean, people were just chopping down their cider orchards because people were making a lot of it. And especially in New England, there's a thing called New England style cider, which is where you're going to add extra sugar and raisins and jack up that alcohol. And when Prohibition was repealed and they were rewriting the laws, cider was not invited to the table. It was pretty much just a winemaker, a brewer, and a hard liquor person.
So is that why in some of the states, yeah, like I know in New York, it wasn't really defined what cider was.
Yeah, and well, thank goodness for who's the senator? He brought back the farm cidery license to New York, and it's done wonders for New York cideries. Schumer,
Chuck Schumer,
yeah. I've been poking my reps for years, saying I want this from Massachusetts. Hasn't gone anywhere yet, but you know
because I work in a lot of different states because I'm an importer and I sell through distributors. I see the regimen in all these different states, and it's all over the map. There's no consistency. Some states have begun to recognize. So for me, there's another level because Peter's talking about the legal production and sale of cider, at the federal level. But then I go into all these states and I have to deal with state regulatory agencies, and they're all over the map. Some have followed the federal thing and begun to recognize cider only since I've been doing it. So before I was, I had to be a wine. And you could contact a state that you have a new distributor in that you're about to go into, and you could be dealing with a functionary in the beverage commission that actually didn't know what to call cider, and they'd have to kind of like pull a rabbit out of the hat, a nice way to say it, pull a rabbit out of the hat with a definition for you so that you can complete your licensing application.
Even in New York, in some of the retail stores, I know there's certain ciders, I think there was and may still be, ciders can be sold based on the ABV. Yes. Not sure 100%.
That's exactly right. And I have to give a tip of the hat to Michelle McGrath and the American Cider Association for being able to flex the muscle and get a rewrite of the federal definition of cider.
So what is it now? What's the federal definition of cider?
It's 7%, isn't it? For ABV? Correct me if I'm wrong.
I'm not up to date. It was 7.5% when I started out. And fortunately, if it has been lowered to 7, it won't affect me because I've got nothing on that cusp. But I don't know for sure. Another issue with regard to definition is that sparkling cider is above a certain pressure. They're sparkling wines, and they get super taxed just like champagnes do. So if people are producing that, they got to know, and I'm sure most of them do know, that they're going to get taxed at a higher level, which is one of the things that makes those more expensive. And it's the same for me bringing it over. If I bring something in over, I don't keep track of the pressure because mine are so far, my sparkling ones are so far over the limit that I don't know what the bottom is. I just pay it,
Yeah, here in Connecticut, the grocery stores don't even sell cider, so we'd only be able to sell in liquor stores.
Wow. Yeah, my stuff always comes in above 7, so I'm just like, yep, we'll pay the tax. That's fine. I'm happy with 8%. That's good. Yeah. 7, 8.
Yeah, and Spanish ciders, traditional Spanish ciders, are typically 6 to 7%. So we're for our basic product in the safe zone and everything that I do except for my brut ciders, my sparkling ciders are below, but my sparkling ciders are you know, taxed, highly taxed.
Yeah. Hey, Jim, let's just go back to Spain for a minute. Asturias, tell us about a couple of your producers or products.
Yeah, sure.
And there's some weird stuff. Like, there's special methods for making these ciders.
Right. So the first thing to say is that for 2,000 years, going back, actually recorded in some Greek traders' logs, they've been making cider continuously in Asturias. So I'm sure people were making, as soon as human met apple, there was probably cider. So we're really talking about probably a prehistoric beverage. But in terms of continuity, the longest continuity currently is from Spain. So the traditional cider that they make is a way that is consistent across the region, spills over into the Basque region, and there's a lot of debate. I know where I stand on it, who's really, you know, the origin point, and a little bit in Cantabria and Galicia, also on the northern coast, but primarily, you know, intense production of the same method, wild yeast fermented, single fermentation, matured over the winter, don't do anything to it. Dealing with the different profiles of the different wild yeasts is experiential. It's not control. It's not Peter Mitchell. It's not treating stuff with chemicals in your laboratory and inoculating them with cultured yeast. You just basically let it go, and then you do what you have to do to come out with it. So, but they make very large volumes, and they have a lot to blend. So, they're about blending to get the flavor profiles balanced across their various batches. And you know, they can harvest the same apples from the same orchards, bring that in, press it, and go into three different very large vats. And in spite of all that sameness, the three batches will be different. So they know that. They've known that for a very long time. The idea of consistency is laughable. So that's defined traditional Spanish cider. And until when I first started importing 10 years ago, I was looking for the best people making the best. But also I wanted to make sure that I was working with people who were interested in developing new cider styles, because I need to survive in a market where not everybody's going to drink a traditional Spanish sidra. And they've done very well by me. So Francisco Ordóñez, who's the head cider maker at Viuda de Angelón, he's a guy who's now recognized as the best cider maker in Spain. He is from a fourth generation cider making family, but he went and studied enology at the University of Valencia, and he worked, he apprenticed and journeyman in the winemaking industry before he came back. And so he has these technical skills. So he's making one of my brut ciders, and I won't go into detail about what the method is. We could do that another time. And he's also using second fermentation, Méthode Charmat, to make a perry. He's the only one making perry. Long story about why they don't make perry over there, but he does. And so I have the only perry made in Spain in my portfolio too. And then doing blends. So we have one blend, which is the Méthode Charmat cider, but it's back sweetened with a little bit of honey from the hives in his orchard. And he's always inventing. He's got an incredible product called 1947 that's used with intensive application of winemaking skills. Love to talk about that sometime. That I would say is one of the finest accomplishments in cider making in the world right now. I mean, it's just an extraordinarily unique, rich product. And then Cedro Riestra, Raul Riestra, the cider maker there, the first time I went to seal my deal with him on his traditional ciders, he had just made his first batch of true Champagne method second fermentation Cedro Brut, with a second fermentation sponsored with an inoculation of a Chardonnay yeast. So it's got some wine character. It's very dry, very smoky, extraordinary. So, and increasingly, there are other people over there that, you know, Spanish cider makers have been doing the same thing forever, but they also are saturating their home regions. There's not a lot of growth left there. Everybody drinks it. And they're actually losing some ground because in the modern world, kids can drink cocktails just as well. And so they have to look to the world market. And so they are experimenting and accomplishing a lot with new styles. And I'm like really happy to kind of like also be present at the creation and the turning point from the one style of cider that I understood to be Spanish cider in previous years. And when I started this, and the new things that are coming out, it's impressive.
How did they react to your chai and dry? Did you taste anyone in Spain?
Yeah, I tasted Raul Riestra and his brother Ruben, whose cider that we use in it. The chai and dry is 2/3 what I can here is good clean funk, which is essentially Sidra Natural Riestra, traditional Sidra, and 1/3 the tea, the unsweetened tea, and a couple of other tricks up our sleeve. And, you know, I couldn't go, I released it at the beginning of COVID. It didn't get a lot of play, obviously, because reps weren't able to go and offer it at stores. So I'm out here doing that now, but, I didn't get to take any to, Ruben and Raul until a few weeks ago. I went over there and, they really dig it. I'll share you a photograph of them tasting it, but also, the bottom line.
If you send it today, that could be the show photo. So.
I have it. I should do that. But I have to say, and I want to be frank about this. You know, these are great people, and they have standards, but they want to sell too. So basically, you know, they're very supportive of anything I do over here. They never tied my hands, and they're my authority. I have people that come to my events and go, you shouldn't do this with Spanish cider. And I can just say back to them, doesn't bother my cider, my Spanish cider makers. Why should it bother you? You know? And especially Raul, I would say, you know, Raul, whatever it takes, you know, as long as I'm moving cider out of his cidery, he's for it.
Do you think that Americans want the long pour and like the real Asturias traditional experience?
Sure they do. I mean, you see it a lot. You know, it's become a meme. People want to do it. I love doing it because when I'm an event with there's like 70 other producers there, or there maybe there's 30 other producers with 70 to 100 other ciders. When I raise my hand up to do that long pour, people see it from across the way and they want to know what's going on. So it's clearly, you know, it's a very attractive thing, and I'm going to put this out there now. Stop using those porrones for cider. That's, you know, that handled glassware thing with the spout. That is not for cider. That's a Basque thing. They trapped you because you were a tourist, and they thought they could get you to drink cider. But you don't drink it that way. Even they don't drink it that way. They either drink it this marvelous high pressure shot right out of the keg into your glass, or a shorter, less showy version of a long pour, which frankly is not long enough for me to imagine it accomplishes anything. But that's just another indication that the Asturians know what they're doing. So, but the real long pour, you know, it's attractive, it excites people, but it also affects the cider. So if you're going to pour from a bottle, you have to do that to get the right quality in your glass. I won't go into detail why, but we can do that another time. My 700 milliliter bottles all come with training wheels for doing that and instructions on the label. And so that's a cool thing. And that's really knowing the tradition, but you know, we also want people to find it our cider however we can. And right now the cans are outselling everything else. Although the bottles that are selling the best of my bottle product are the traditionals. That you pour that way.
Oh, that's great. Hey, Ron, we're going to wrap up soon, but, you know, you worked with Jim. You reintroduced us last year. Do you want to say anything else about what he's doing?
I mean, I love Spanish cider, and I think Jim's bringing over some of the best, and if you have a chance to go to Asturias, it's like a whole other world over there. It's like just cider on every corner. It's amazing. It's like here in America, we have Dunkin' Donuts and Starbucks. Over there, it's like cider just about every corner. And I'd much prefer, you know, cider on every corner than...
That's a great one, Ron.
There's a spot, I can't remember where, might be Fall River, has a Dunkin' Donuts on 3 or 4 corners in one neighborhood.
It's crazy. But I'm also, Peter, I've actually fermented some of his apples, so...
And you're still standing.
Yeah, it works.
Hey, so Ron, nobody in the died. Few minutes we got left, you know, cider is... Now, there's a difference between simple and easy, but making cider is technically simple. And I think a lot of people can start doing it themselves. Is there some sort of home brewing thing that people can get into?
Yeah, actually, Sina is starting to talk about a entry-level course, like more on the home brewer introduction to how cider is made. So that will probably be announced soon.
Of course, I'm going to go to hell now because I use the term brewing and cider in the same sentence. Sorry.
Yeah, cider isn't brewed, but home brewers can make cider. So there is that.
Well, you know, I'm going to run for office, and I'm going to put a chicken in every pot, and it's cider on every corner in my
cider, cider trees
in my town.
You got my vote. You're going to run in Massachusetts?
I don't think so, gentlemen. but let's wrap it. And Peter, for you, any last words for us?
Yes.
You gotta go. What are you gonna go back outside and do? I think if anything, I learned from just how hard this business is, whether it's bottling, running a business, making the cider, selling, planting the trees.
Well, allegedly that mower is being delivered from Iowa in about 30 minutes, so I gotta get the forklift started. Hopefully, it will start. And get out there and unload the truck. The June drop of apples has already started. But other than that, it's looking like a good crop this year. Last year was a wet year, so we had a lot of juice, but not a lot of sugar in it. Things are looking pretty darn good this year, knock wood.
Yeah.
Hopefully going to bottle the ice cider early next spring. And that's about it. Just keep on growing, keep on grafting, planting new trees. Yeah, it's always something going on.
Well, listen, I really appreciate you guys coming on last minute. I'm in the cider vibe. And
okay, go to Cider Feast in Haverhill.
Oh, yeah, north of Boston. But
Cider Feast.
If you're in Massachusetts, sure. And that's it, guys. Thanks to Armin and Alex, our crew. Armin Spengen, our engineer. Alex Tran, our producing intern. Thanks so much to Ron, Peter, and James for joining me here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo. Thank you.
Better on.
Better on.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.